CBSi in the world. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. The most important election in Africa, perhaps on the planet, in 2023 is the election in Nigeria. And Gregory is here to introduce us to the major candidates and the choice that is coming to the Nigerian people in late February. February 25th is the schedule. Gregory, we begin with the candidates and the vision for the future. I start with someone I profiled thanks to The Economist magazine, Peter Obi. We talked to him before. He is a favorite among the internet-using urban youth. What does he represent for Nigeria's future?
To ask what Peter Obi means for the future of Nigeria assumes that he has a position there, because he really does not have significant national support. He is popular in some of the cities, particularly with some of the youth who express themselves strongly on social media. But most of those youth are not registered to vote, and they are in the urban center areas of the south and southeast and southwest of the country. And this is not enough to get him elected. He is also now, despite his the clear brilliance of his oratory and the common sense of many of his policies, he is now coming under attack as being possibly the least qualified of the presidential candidates going into the race. He's also not really fully disclosing his origins as an Igbo man. And bear in mind, the Igbo are the people who brought us the Biafra separatist movement some time ago. So the Biafra Igbo people have disavowed Peter as their candidate. So it's an interesting situation. On the face of it, he says the right things. He has the right vice presidential candidate and the like, but he is not really going to go anywhere. And he peaked very early because, let's face it, it's easy to peak in the cities when you can get access to the open media, and the open media and the social media are not evident in much of Nigeria. And accurate polling is absolutely impossible in Nigeria. We see how poorly the conventional polling services perform in major Western industrial societies. In Nigeria, polling is absolutely misleading in the extreme because you just can't get to the voters. So Peter Obi is, you know, going to be interesting. He's going to perform relatively well, but he's not going to get anywhere near leading, because the two major parties, the PDP and the AC, are the ones that are going to be APC are going to be the ones right. that are
Let's go to the APC. Bola Tinubu. What do we need to know about his vision?
Well, Bola Tinubu is the former governor of Lagos State. He's a Muslim, and it's probably 50-50 Muslim and Christian. But he has also has a Muslim vice presidential candidate, which offends a lot of Nigerians, because they feel if you've got a Muslim presidential candidate, you should have a Christian vice presidential candidate, or vice versa. And Tinubu has bucked that trend. He's also been very smug. He went to London recently, where he spoke at Chatham House, and then wouldn't answer any questions. He passed all of the questions over to his team, and that went down extremely badly in Nigeria itself. So Tinubu is seen as also incapable of handling Nigeria on a national and international scale. Certainly, he was a deal maker at a local level when he was a very successful governor of Lagos State. But he's very, very wealthy. He's the wealthiest of the candidates. He is complacent. He is not energetic. He's actually younger than Atiku Abubakar, the PDP candidate, but far less dynamic and has not come up with any policies. He said, I'll grow the Nigerian GDP by 7%, 10%, and this sort of thing. And then you ask him, how are you going to do it? He has zero policy options at his disposal or at his in his planning cycle. So basically, Tinubu is really falling through the cracks as well. And it's interesting that in a country which is clearly much more civilized than most, Nigeria has put a hold on its election campaigning over the Christmas New Year holiday period. So that gives them all the candidates time to rethink and regroup and come out by about mid-January with their new postures. And it remains to be seen whether Tinubu can come out with something which makes him look knowledgeable and authoritative and that he can actually show some prestige and stature in the marketplace.
And now you've mentioned Atiku Abubakar, the PDP party. What is his vision of the future?
Well, he's very much a pro-Western free market thinker. He advocates smaller government. He advocates privatization of major state enterprises and getting the government out of the way of the entrepreneur. And he recognizes the reality that Nigerians have basically prospered in the past decade by ignoring the government. So the government has been going on stealing money, if you like, from the oil deals and the like. And this has not affected the average Nigerian who's gone about his business without reference to the government. You know, the government, it's a black economy, if you like. The government isn't able to reach a lot of it for taxation purposes. People just go about growing food, trading, and doing whatever they need to do to survive without reference to the government. So they have very little faith in the government anyway. And what Atiku is saying is that, look, we're there to help you to take control of your life and to keep the government out of your way. Where the government needs to act, it will do so by helping to stimulate the economy, by stimulating education and occupational sectors. It will also transform the security environment in a way which is plausible, and it's identified ways to make sure that the military and the policing systems are no longer seen as separate to the society. What's happened as the security situation has worsened is that many people in Nigeria view the armed forces and the police with equal fear to the terrorist organizations. So clearly the people on Atiku's team are going to be rebuilding that relationship and getting rid of what has been a very corrupt military leadership caused not only by the current president, Buhari, but also his predecessor, Goodluck Jonathan, who was also a PDP president as well.
We go to Ethiopia, a horrible year of civil war, of massive violence. Here towards the end, the Tigray Popular Liberation Front that led the largest charge on Addis Ababa is apparently tamed and contained. Prime Minister Abiy, can we describe him? Is at peace at the end of the year, or is there more fighting ahead?
Well, it looks like there will not be any more serious fighting between the government forces and the breakaway TPLF militia, which called its militia the Tigrayan Armed Forces, but they were not. They were just a terrorist group which happened to be well armed. So that war is very over. The TPLF has been defeated. They've accepted that defeat, and they will be surrendering their weapons consistently over the next weeks and month or so. They have been trying to wait until they had guarantees that the Eritrean military forces, which had been in Ethiopia, had been withdrawn. That's starting to happen. And the reality is that the United States, which had been secretly backing the TPLF, has stopped doing that. It's recognized that the government of Prime Minister Abiy has won that part of the civil war, and they welcomed Prime Minister Abiy to Washington at the African summit last week. That was highly significant, and Prime Minister Abiy did have meetings with U.S. officials. I believe he also met with President Biden. So that's actually a major turning point. Certainly, though, there's another civil war underway and has been underway for decades involving the Oromo Liberation Front and the Oromo Liberation Army and various spin-offs of that. This is also an ethnic separatist organization, as the TPLF has been, and they are not yet conquered. And Prime Minister Abiy is himself half Oromo, or he says fully Oromo. But anyway, he's basically been regarded by the rest of Ethiopia as being compromised by this, the existence of the OLF, the Oromo Liberation Front. Now he's declared war on them in an unbridled fashion. So we may see that resolving. As well, we've seen the government open up to private foreign investment in Ethiopian banks and other enterprises. We're seeing Ethiopia, despite the La Nina weather pattern coming back for the third consecutive year, the Ethiopian agricultural sector is getting ready to become a net exporter of wheat, which is a major step forward. So things are looking very optimistic, or guardedly optimistic, for Ethiopia. Now the Prime Minister will be pressed to deliver on some of his promises to basically institute reforms to the old communist constitution and restore private ownership of property, and that will be the great stimulus which drives a new wave of foreign direct investment. So we're waiting to see just how quickly and how well he will do that.
Has there been a rapprochement between Abiy and some European critics and some American critics, chiefly the State Department and the foreign ministries in Europe? Have they all come to terms?
Well, I think the State Department surrendered along with the TPLF. There was no question that the U.S. observers at the ceasefire or peace talks, which began in Pretoria a month or so ago, were highly cognizant of the fact that this was not about a ceasefire between the TPLF and the federal forces. This was the surrender of the TPLF and the recognition by the State Department observers that they now had to deal with Prime Minister Abiy, and as a result, they welcomed him to Washington last week. Now, some of the Europeans, particularly the British, recognized about literally a year ago in November 2021 that the U.S. line on Ethiopia was highly damaging to the Western position in the Horn of Africa and the Red Sea Suez sea lanes dispute. So the British government a year ago began hedging its bets and started offering increased aid to the Ethiopian government, and has been rebuilding the normalcy, if you like, of their relationship and with Ethiopia. And the Ethiopian government itself has opened up a lot and, for example, has started welcoming back people like Emperor Haile Selassie's grandson, who's the head of the Ethiopian crown in exile. So he's now able to go back into the country and meets at the highest levels. He was recently, 2 weeks ago, honored in Addis Ababa by the Ethiopian government with a presentation of a big trophy to commemorate the creation of the African Union by Prince Hermes's grandfather, the Emperor Haile Selassie. So things are really moving back to a normalization. The Ethiopian economy is still far from great, but it is getting ready to get back to its building. And it was before the State Department started sponsoring the TPLF, it had the fastest growing economy in Africa. And it's likely to return to that position in the near future if Nigeria doesn't itself take that position again.
Quickly, South Africa. President Cyril Ramaphosa, reelected leader of the governing African National Congress in a party leadership contest. The announcement comes at the end of ANC and National Elective Conference. Last week, Ramaphosa survived a move to start impeachment proceedings against him in a vote in Parliament. I mentioned that he was returning from London, where he enjoyed the attention of King Charles III in a state visit. Is Ramaphosa now secure, Gregory? We have about a minute.
Well, Ramaphosa is certainly much more secure than he was. The People's Republic of China, I think, were pushing their allies within the African National Congress to scare Ramaphosa with the threats of impeachment and the like, because Beijing was very unhappy that Ramaphosa undertook that state visit to the UK and met with King Charles, which started the reconstruction of the Pretoria-London alliance. This really scares Beijing, because Beijing has regarded South Africa as its primary ally in Africa. Now, they did succeed in scaring Cyril Ramaphosa, but Ramaphosa nonetheless won that re-election. And now Beijing is going to still have to deal with him. But Ramaphosa, I think, will be a little more cautious. And in the past, he was very, very loyal to Beijing. He was doing Beijing's bidding in trying to overthrow and unseat the king of Eswatini, Swaziland, the neighboring country. That may actually be scaled back under Ramaphosa II.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We mentioned King Charles. We're headed there for our King Charles report, and there's positive information all the time now. King Charles is looking to stabilize the crown, and with it, the British people having a very difficult winter in terms of the war in Europe, as well as the electricity costs, and now the strikes of railroads, nurses, NHS. You cannot believe all the categories that are said to be on strike or threatening strike. When we come back, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.